You're listening to Conservation Connection,
presented by Last Chance Endeavors.
I'm Chance.
I'm Sarah Catherine.
We're a husband and wife team running a wildlife education nonprofit focused on connecting students to their environment.
Each week, here on Conservation Connection, we do just that by introducing you to the groundbreaking science and conservation work that's happening every day across the globe.
We talk to professionals working to protect our planet and ask them about their career,
their current projects,
their wild and crazy stories from the field,
and everything in between.
This episode is a collaboration with the Sun Valley Forum in Sun Valley, Idaho, and was made possible through a generous donation by the Nancy P. and Richard K. Robbins Family Foundation.
The Sun Valley Forum is an intergenerational meeting of forward-thinking professionals that come from a diverse range of disciplines.
These experts are on the cutting edge of what's happening in the fight for our future, and they've all come together at the Sun Valley Forum to share ideas and collaborate on solutions for a greener tomorrow.
Let's get to the show.
Alrighty, guys, welcome to another episode of Conservation Connection. We are here in Sun Valley, Idaho for the Sun Valley Forum, and I am incredibly excited this episode to be sitting down with Vic Barrett, who is a plaintiff in the case Juliana v. the United States, and Christy Cooper, who is the director and producer of the documentary Youth v. Gov, which is currently available on Netflix, which details what happened in the case Juliana v. the United States. So welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for making time to join us. I guess let's start with, what is Youth v. Gov? What does this documentary cover?
Yeah, so the film follows these young people. Vic is one of 21 young people who are suing the U.S. federal government for violating their constitutional rights to a stable climate. And basically, the case is based on their constitutional rights to life, liberty, property, and personal security. And I followed their stories over the course of 6 years, the ups and downs through this case, their personal climate impacts. We do a deep investigative dive into what the government has known and what the government's own scientists were telling them over the past 60 years, the decisions that they've made to lock us into a fossil fuel-based energy system, and basically the premise of this case and why these young people, why all of us have a constitutional right to a stable climate system.
I can't imagine following filming and producing a movie, a documentary, a show, whatever it might be, for 6 years. Is that common for you? Like, is that how long this typically takes?
There's a range of production times that feature documentaries have. This was definitely a passion project for me. So I was willing to, you know, kind of put all of myself into this for as long as it was going to take to do it. The interesting thing is that the story is still ongoing. So I had to make a decision at some point that the film was going to end because the story definitely has not ended. But it felt like a really important time right now for the story to come out and for people to understand what this case is about so that they can get behind the plaintiffs and the work that they're doing and get behind, you know, the lawsuit and support the organization, Our Children's Trust, who is representing these young people. And, you know, we're really at a pivotal moment, I think, in history where our government is making a lot of choices. And we're seeing that right now, you know, even with the Ukraine war and are doubling down, presumably, on oil and gas. And these are aspects of our energy policy system that folks need to know about and need to be engaged in. And our courts and our judicial system is such an important piece of all of this. And so it was really a decision to, like, let's get this story out there and let's create some movement around it.
I think one of the things that really struck me from the film is how many times we were like at this pivotal moment and something could have shifted, and over and over and over the government keeps making poor decisions that push us into locking us into this fossil fuel climate system. And I think I kind of had sort of an intuitive idea that, you know, yeah, people have been making poor decisions around our energy use for a very long time. Decision makers have, but the sort of deep dive that you go into, like talking about the oil crisis in the 70s, and there was this really big boom of renewable energy as a discussion, as a solution to this energy crisis, and then we double down on coal, you know, and I really appreciate the deep dive that happened in the documentary that very plainly, I mean, in a legal style, right? In the idea of like, we have to pull together airtight evidence that they knew about it. They knew it was causing damage and they chose to do it anyway.
That's right. And this is all, I mean, Vic, maybe you want to talk about this, but this is all evidence in the case as well that has not yet been presented before the courts.
Yeah, and I really like the point you brought up about action, because for a lot of when the lawsuit started, we had to kind of continue to reiterate to people that it wasn't about climate inaction, it was about the direct action that the government was taking. So I'm glad that the film has like kind of really clarified that as well, because it's such an important part of the case. And we're really lucky to have so many experts on the case and so much evidence. And it's like insane that after 6 years, everything that we've been through has just been procedural. Like, we have not had a chance to put any of the facts in front of the government and have them answer to it, but they had the opportunity to depose us.
Which, that was a crazy scene where you were sitting here being asked questions. I mean, okay, if you're listening right now and you want to watch Youth v. Gov without anything being spoiled, pause the episode, go watch it, and then come back, because there's stuff that I have to talk about here. So, like, sitting down in that deposition, how did you feel? I mean, obviously, I know how you felt about that, but can you talk a little bit about what that process was like for you?
I felt annoyed for you.
Yeah, it was really like daunting at first, because our lawyers were just really wanting to make sure that everything was airtight. So there were certain things we had to kind of like disclose to them in case it would come up in the deposition and things like that. When you're a kid, you're just like, what are these people going to ask me? What does the government know about me that they're going to try to like?
Did you stay out past curfew?
Yeah. but yeah, it was definitely really nerve-wracking and also just exhausting, because the questions were intentionally really roundabout or intentionally vague, or, you know, something that
incredibly inappropriate.
Yeah. And just, you know, questions that they didn't really even know answers to. And it was interesting. In my deposition, they asked me how I knew that sea level rise was going to impact the island of Manhattan. And I told them NOAA predictions. And NOAA is a government agency.
Right. So, aren't you talking to each other?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's like, I'm getting the information from you guys. So it was definitely really, really daunting. And it was hard, too, to see, like, some of the younger plaintiffs. And just, like, even in the room, like, it was pretty tangible how, like, scared they were.
How many people were in the room with you for that?
Yeah, so it was me, my lawyer, like the government lawyer who was asking me questions, and maybe one other government lawyer, and then there's a
court reporter.
Someone who's typing away everything that you're saying.
And my lawyer Phil came out to Maddox, because our lawyers came to us in the they came to us for the depositions. So my lawyer Phil came to Madison, Wisconsin, and the deposition was like in the conference room of like a Marriott off the highway. And I remember when we had a break, he like took me to get lunch at like Red Robin or something, because we were just in the middle of nowhere.
And it's like, is that even real life?
Yeah,
you know, like
exactly.
How am I being deposed by the government for a case, and also I'm in a Marriott conference room and about to eat Red Robin?
Yeah, exactly. So it was definitely an interesting experience. And it lasted for a long time. Like, I mean, I guess you must have had to go through a lot of the footage, but like, I don't know, the fact that you were able to cut it up, because I'm pretty sure, like, mine was a few hours. Like, the fact that we had to take a break for lunch.
I feel like most of you actually were like an entire day. I know, yeah. Kelsey had 2 days of depositions. Yeah. And the experts were all deposed as well. And I mean, they were super extensive. We had to go through all of that footage to find like these, you know, I wish we could have put so much more of it in the film, because it is really powerful to see these stupid questions that the government was posing to the plaintiffs, who are not the scientists. They're not the experts. And they're, you know, they're basically suggesting that they should be experts on all of this. Yeah. I mean, like the question that they asked Jacob, like, have you gone back in history and measured, you know, carbon? Like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like getting run over by a car. And then like when you're talking about it, having somebody be like, well, can you tell me exactly the compression pressures that occur in the fifth cylinder of that engine? It's like, yeah. That's not why I'm here. I'm not here to tell you exactly how
I'm
the car
injured.
Works. I'm the one that got hit by the car.
Right.
Right. Yeah. I can tell you it moves fast and it hurt.
It's a great analogy.
It is.
So, Vic, how old were you when all of this first started, when you got involved?
Yeah, I was 15 years old.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what led you to being involved with this case? Like, were you always concerned for the environment? Did it kind of happen? I mean, again, 15. So, like, at a later age, like, you know, 14 or something, that you were like, oh, this is an issue. But yeah, how'd you get involved?
Yeah. Well, when I started my freshman year of high school, I had just moved from like a pretty isolated conservative part of upstate New York. And I just wanted to get involved in kind of everything that was the antithesis of that. And I was fortunate enough to go to school in the West Village, so it wasn't too difficult, the contrast. But yeah, I just got involved in after school programs, mostly with the human rights lens in mind. Then this program that I joined was like, we would love for you guys to work on a campaign that has to do with climate change. And I remember at first being like, what does that have to do with human rights? I've never been much of a science buff either. So I was like, what are we doing? But then we learned a lot about Hurricane Sandy, as an example, as young people in New York City, and how people who live in low-income housing and people of color tend to be put on the front lines of natural disasters, and just learned all these implications of climate change on already vulnerable communities. And that was also at the same time that like Black Lives Matter was really kicking off and becoming something that I was super aware of. So I was seeing this like really like on the news, this really visceral violence and then against Black people, and then learning about this like slow violence that people don't talk about as much. And it just became something that I got really invested in, especially with my own identities, thinking about where my family's from, on the northern coast of Honduras, dealing with sea level rise. And yeah, it just became something I kind of couldn't ignore. Just, you know, with how big of an issue it is. I guess that's like the existential part of it. It just became something that I couldn't not do something about. And so I was working on campaigns in New York City, but having to deal a lot with like city council members and people you have to vote for, which I couldn't do. And legislators who like, you know, didn't feel accountable to me necessarily. Not that they usually feel accountable to their voters either, but and I was kind of frustrated with that process and kind of brought it up to some mentors that I had had in high school at that point who had worked with Our Children's Trust, the organization that puts on the lawsuit, had worked with Our Children's Trust in the past. And yeah, I just ended up getting connected with the organization. We talked a lot about my lived experience, my harms of climate change. And then eventually it was just like, yeah, we're doing this federal lawsuit. Are you trying to sue the U.S. federal government? And I was like, huh, yeah, that seems
like you want to join.
Yeah.
Was there ever a moment where that just felt like an insane idea, like bringing a lawsuit against the federal, I mean, the name defendant is literally the United States of America, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just feel like that would be a really hard pill. If I had been asked in that position, be like, are you willing to be on the front line of this? I would have to really step back and consider the implications of that. So like, what was it like for you to come to that decision that, yes, this is how I want to make a difference?
Yeah. I think, you know, just in my like youthful naivety, I was kind of just like sick. Let's go. But also as a minor, I remember something that's interesting is my mom's name had to be on the lawsuit too. I don't remember exactly how they listed it when we were minors, but it was like, you know, I don't know, dependent of Daisy Calderon, Vic Barrett, something like that. But my mom's name was
the guardian.
Yeah, exactly. Under the guardianship of, or something like that. And, I thought that was interesting. And my mom was the one that was more like, are you sure? Because also my mom is from Honduras, and that's not a country where you sue the government without any implications.
Yes. Right, absolutely.
So I think that, you know, with that being her lived experience, she had a little bit more hesitancy. But she's always been really trusting of me and the decisions that I want to make. She's always been really supportive. I mean, even in my, like, freshman year of high school, I got to go on a State Department trip to Bosnia, and I was the youngest kid on the trip, and I always give her a lot of props just for all the things she let me do when I was a kid, because a lot of parents wouldn't just send their kids to a place that was a war zone 20 years ago and trust them to be able to, you know, carry their own. And she trusted a lot my mentors too, and just the lawyers and the people that I had been spending a lot of time with after school, to, you know, make sure I was making the right decision.
Yeah, and that really speaks to the importance of a strong support group, like having people around you that share your values, or not necessarily share your values, but trust you that what you care about matters to you and is something worth investing their energy in. And, you know, I'm very similar. I had a mom that, and a dad, both my parents are incredibly supportive of what I did. And like, I was diving with sharks off the coast of the Bahamas with experimental magnet arrays when I was like 15 or 16. Because my mom was like, sure, you can do that for science fair or whatever. Not whatever. She was terrified the whole time, but she was willing to let me do it. And that's, you know, it's really, really important to have that kind of support system. So props to your mom for like being there for you, and props to you for caring about it and being willing to like take these big steps.
And I would also add something that I think the plaintiffs weren't expecting. I don't know that anybody was really expecting, but like a couple months after they filed the lawsuit against the government, the entire fossil fuel industry intervened in the case. And so all of a sudden it was these 21 kids against the United States government and the entire fossil fuel industry and all of them, like the National Association of Manufacturers. And they were in the courtroom with not only the DOJ attorneys, but the attorneys representing the fossil fuel industries. And I mean, it was, that was something, Vic, that you guys were not expecting.
Yeah. No, like taking on the most powerful country in the world and like arguably one of the most powerful industries in the world at the same time. And, you know, you have Levi, he's 8, right? Like, yeah. You know, and that's his like reality at the time. It was definitely interesting. And also just, I think a lot of times, I think back to just sitting in the courtroom, we always sat together in the front rows as the plaintiffs. And I think that was really important because it just made it this really stark image of, you know, like, here's literally a bunch of kids between, like, when we first started, between the ages of, like, 8 and
19,
like, sitting here. And then here's you guys really just trying to do everything you can to prevent them from,
you know, having any sense of justice or, like, a livable life.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
That's not important at all, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like, how do you look at these children and say, like, oh, yeah, we don't want to allow you to talk. Like, we're going to sit here and, like, keep you going through this rigmarole and everything before you can ever say what you really want to say.
Yeah. And then also just like the rhetoric sometimes too, like of them talking about the, you know, there's, you can't blame the harms that these kids are going through on the US federal government, or just really trying to downplay our experience. Where at the same time, like Jaden's house just got flooded in Louisiana and like she was going to have to totally relocate. And then you're sitting here in your actual US federal government be like, small potato.
Like, it's fine. It's not a big deal.
Or your harm isn't individualized enough.
Exactly.
That is something that I really liked about the film, is how diverse of a group that y'all had on this case. Not just in color, age, gender, but also in location. You know, I think there's parts of the documentary that can be relatable to pretty much anyone, depending on where they are. You know, during the film, you cover Hurricane Irma. At the time of Hurricane Irma, Chance and I were living in the Florida Keys. And so we went back down and had to help rebuild basically where we lived. You know, our house, thankfully, that we were renting was fine, but we had plenty of friends who, like, their house was completely flooded or just completely gone. So, you know, it was relatable for that part. The whole documentary really is relatable in many ways, but that part specifically was relatable. And I think lots of people who have seen or will see this documentary will be able to relate to different portions in different ways as well.
It's purely indicative of who is impacted by climate change now, right? This is so present and omnipresent now within our country that these young people that are on this case are really representative of all young people around the world, right? Who are impacted in all of the various ways that climate impacts are affecting us, whether it's drought or wildfires or food insecurity or increased intensity of storms and hurricanes, like, yeah, heat waves. I mean, asthma, health,
like,
you know, health
on,
issues.
This list is like 100 things long, right? So it is absolutely relatable to everybody, 100%.
Yeah. And it is, I mean, as Vic mentioned, it is often those people, the marginalized communities on the front lines. But I think now with the increased impacts of climate change, you know, other people are starting to feel it too. And, you know, I think that these young people in this film, I mean, there's, you know, farmers and city folks and it's just so, the impacts are so broad and so diverse now that it's kind of hard to look away.
Yeah. And I think one of the other things is that, like, for people who are not youth, who have lived on the planet for a much longer period of time, they can point to bad storms from their childhood. And back then, yeah, it was a bad storm. You know, it was a one-off. It came by and it left. And yeah, it was awful and terrible. And so that's the mindset that they have, is that it's not a climate change issue. It's just these have always happened. But there's so much evidence to say that these have gotten worse. And there's so many scientists that say these are the ways in which the CO2 emissions, our gas emissions, are directly connected to the changing of rainfall patterns, which produces drought in some places and flooding storms in others, or it changes the way that the waters move in the ocean and therefore creates terrible hurricanes that are much more frequent than they ever used to be. And so for youth, this is all we've ever known, is this massive disruption to our climate system, as opposed to people that didn't necessarily grow up with that or didn't realize that that's what it was, because it wasn't as blatantly obvious back then.
Yeah, I feel like I've heard, and I feel like even as another example, I feel like maybe I've heard you say, or maybe it's said in the film, but I don't think so because your voice isn't in the film. And I feel like I remember you saying maybe during a presentation, but like Jaden was living through a 100-year flood,
a thousand year
flood, but that were happening, you know, not every thousand years,
yeah, right?
Far more frequently than that.
Yeah, and that's a technical term that scientists use to describe the severity of various natural climate events. You know, this is a 1,000-year storm. This is a 500-year storm. It's a 100-year storm.
That's happening every 2 years.
That
now
is now happening like several times. You know, even more than once a season, right? And so, one of the early episodes of this podcast, we talked to the climate scientist who looks at like weather modeling, basically. And he was talking about how historically the science of modeling the weather is looking at what the weather was over the past 20 years and interpreting what we're seeing today to see what tomorrow looks like through the lens of what it's been for the last, you know, this historical data. And he says they can no longer do that. Those no longer produce accurate models of what the weather is going to look like in the near future, because we don't have the historical data that matches with what our climate system is today. So now they're moving into predictive modeling, where they're, as opposed to relying on historical data, they're looking at like, okay, now we have to actually crunch the numbers and see how things are going to move, as opposed to relying on our past experience. And like, that's insane. That, you know, yeah. We're sitting here in this lovely conference room having this lovely conversation, and I feel like I should be screaming, because the things that we're talking about are so big and so global. I mean, there's no other word for it than global. It reaches everywhere. And it's just, I'm just glad to be having this conversation with you guys and continuing to amplify it, because I think everybody needs to hear it.
I want to get back to, you know, we talked about like production and directing, and like you've been doing this for 6 years, and that's a long time, and the case isn't even done. At some point you had to decide, okay, we're going to go ahead and produce this, make it into a documentary, get it out there for people to see. So with that being said, do you plan to make another film, another documentary, or just kind of to keep people updated on the future? And with that question, what does the future look like for this case right now?
Yeah, I think the future will tell, you know, what kind of future stories come out of this. Everything is so up in the air right now. You know, we definitely plan to continue to do outreach and awareness and as much as we can about this case through YouthVGov and through this story, and to support whatever, you know, direction the case takes and support the plaintiffs in that. The Vic, do you want to update on where the case stands today?
Yeah, sure, I can do that. So right now, the last thing that has happened is we filed a motion to amend. So a motion to amend our complaint, basically, instead of asking for the U.S. federal court system to ask the other branches to implement a climate, like a drawdown plan, instead of asking for that, we're just asking for them to declare that a stable climate is a constitutional right. So there's a basis for that. the Supreme Court just making declarations, like in Brown versus Board of Education, the Supreme Court saying that that was no longer right, had to force the other branches of government to act. So that's where we're at right now. And we're waiting for a decision back on that motion to amend from Judge Ann Aiken so that we can go to trial and hopefully actually put the evidence that we have in front of the government. But we're feeling pretty confident about it because Judge Ann Aiken was the judge that gave us the first really profound decision that a stable climate system is fundamental to a safe
and free and ordered
society, which was really, really impactful to have a federal judge say.
And that's really at the crux of the case, right? Is all you want is, I mean, all we want is the people to stop doing this, right? That's the biggest thing. But in the case specifically, the intent is to have the judicial branch of the government look at the facts of the case and say the decisions that have been made by the U.S. government have caused harm. They were done knowingly and they need to stop, right? And saying that the youth and everybody living in this nation, but the youth are disproportionately impacted, have a right to a stable climate system that allows life to continue on planet Earth, right? That's the core of it, right? Is that you want a judge to say, yes, there's a constitutional right to a stable climate.
Yes.
And literally just having that statement from a member of the judicial branch of the government can set precedent on which future decisions are hinge upon, right?
It also means that the government can't continue doing the harm, right? If that Absolutely. Constitutional claim is established, then the government can no longer, well, I guess they can, but then they're violating those constitutional rights, right?
Yeah.
So having that claim first established, and you know, as Vic mentioned in Brown versus Board of Education, 1954 was when the court said that segregation was violating these young people's rights. It wasn't until the following year in 1955 that the courts then mandated that the schools implement these desegregation policies. So you need first this claim to be established and you need this constitutional right to exist. And that's really important. But, you know, we're also going to, time will tell here when we do get Judge Aiken's decision, how the Biden administration is going to respond. Are they going to take the same position that the Trump administration did and take extraordinary legal measures to, you know, to block this case? Are they going to file a writ of mandate and shoot it back up to the Supreme Court, you know, with the hopes of getting it dismissed before any of the evidence is ever presented. So it's going to be interesting to see how the Biden administration responds to that. And I think this would be my call to action to, I guess, folks that are watching this film and following this case is, you know, to really stay engaged on that and put the pressure on the Biden administration to let these plaintiffs go to trial, let them have their evidence heard. I think that's, we all need that evidence to be presented. We need this on record.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I mean, as we said, this has been going on for 6 years. So regardless of what administration is in office, it's like, don't take it personally. Just be the change, you know?
If and
you
let can just the legal be the process happen.
Exactly.
Everybody should be, I mean, we, I can't even. Everybody should have the right to their day in court, right? Mm-hmm. You should have your case due process happen with your legal case. And like the fact that we're 6 years in and your case has not been heard is insane to me. Like I just, it's infuriating. It makes me want to go march in the streets, and hopefully it makes everybody listening also want to go march in the streets.
So I do think we could talk about this forever, and hopefully in the future we'll be able to follow up with y'all once again. But to kind of wrap up this episode, I want to ask Vic, what do you think your future in terms of like work, what you want to be, what you want to do in the future? What does that look like for you? Do you think that this case has kind of changed your path, or are you still kind of like, oh, this is what I want to be? Like, I want to be an astronaut when I grow up. I don't know.
Being an astronaut would be pretty cool. But I think the crazy kind of whirlwind experience of being a plaintiff on the case, like the place that I've gotten to go and the experiences I've gotten to have definitely impacted my thoughts on what I want to do. I know that a lot of my interests lie in communication and media and storytelling and basically just trying to get people to understand each other. during the conference here, and a lot, I talk a lot about empathy being one of the key tools to moving forward, like moving past this crisis. And I think that empathy is often garnered through storytelling, conversations like this right here. So I don't know, maybe one day I'll have a podcast.
Yes, absolutely.
Heck yeah. Give us a call. We'll make that happen for sure.
We will help you.
Well, so if people wanted to find Youth v. Gov, we've already said you can watch the documentary on Netflix. Is there anywhere else that I can link people to kind of stay updated on the case or any future projects you guys may have?
Yeah, people can learn more about the film at youthvgovfilm.com. That's a great place to go. And we have also educational licenses available. The film is available to schools and for community screenings through Good Docs. And those links are on our website for those licenses. And, you know, we'd love for people to reach out to us if they would like to hold community screenings. We can always help them, you know, pair them with folks that can join those screenings. And people can learn much more about the case by going to ourchildrenstrust.org. They can learn about the Juliana case. And also our Children's Trust is representing young people in ongoing state cases right now. And it would be very interesting for folks to know that Montana, the state case in Montana, is going to be the very first constitutional climate change lawsuit that is going to trial next February in 2023.
Awesome. So if you guys are listening and hopefully want to stay engaged with what's happening, scrolling down to the show notes, I'm going to drop those links right there so you can go straight from listening to the show to learning more, diving in even a little bit deeper. Thank you guys so much for taking the time to sit down with us. This was such a fun episode.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you. This was awesome.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Conservation Connection.
If you enjoyed our podcast, go ahead and subscribe to make sure you catch every episode that we post.
We'd love to hear from you. So if you want to reach out, go to our website, lastchanceendeavors.com/contact, and shoot us an email.
We love questions from our listeners, so if you heard something that you want to know more about, be sure to let us know.
If you've got a minute to spare, leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts will help other conservation-minded people find the show. We'd really appreciate it.
A big thanks to the people working to protect our planet, and a big thanks to you for listening. Don't forget to tune in next week.